Hi, can you hear me? Yeah. Just a brief, just a brief comment just to start a conversation. I don't know if you remember, Howard, but there was a very short-lived series of articles in the Standard in the 1980s, which I enjoyed when I read them, called "The Place Where I Live." And it was more about just like the it wasn't as personalized as what the life and times. But I remember there was like maybe four or five articles. I think it was around about 84, 85. I think it was by in different writers. I think Peter Lawrence, late Peter Lawrence, wrote an article. Ron Cook was writing about the West Midlands. Carl Pinnell, I think. And I can't remember the last one. It might have been another far old, past comrade called Les Dale, I think. And it was just, if people want to kind of hunt them down, they're either on the party website or on my blog. I probably have them on the label "Place Where I Live," and it's kind of similar idea to what you're suggesting, but maybe just more generalized, about just about like the regional history of where they live, etc. Yeah, it's just thought I'd throw that in before other people contribute. Thank you.
Thanks, Darren. You've got a memory. And I've forgotten about those, I have to say. Yeah. But yeah, it reflects some of the points I was making there. I'll look those up definitely. Brian Johnson, over to you.
Yes, the one writer that really stands out for me is Heather Ball. Her articles, very, very good. I mean, a lot of our articles were put together in the form of a pamphlet by Mike Gill and Sam Parker. Talking about Mike Gill, he used to do a theatre column, which was very good as well. Excellent, all of that stuff. It's very rare that articles in the vein of Heather Ball comes up, but it was straight from the how can I put it, the mindset of a working class person. She took the view of how to explain it and laid it out there all bare. That's my bit. Thank you.
Yes, Heather Ball, great stuff. Yeah, I agree with you, Brian. It was a great pity we, she's not still around, but I agree with you entirely. A lot of sort of, materials appeared in the Standard by various different writers who, I've not mentioned either because I've forgotten or because, you can only mention sort of so many, and I was sort of looking along certain lines. But I mean, very good idea to sort of mention them now so that people can remember, and if necessary, look them up, because so many of them are available now on the party's website. Andy, your turn.
Oh, thanks, Howard. That was lovely. It was just what I needed, actually, on this Friday evening after a very busy week. Do you know what? You could have your own spot on Radio 4. You've got such a soothing voice and such a nice way to put the language across. And I really enjoyed it. It did set me thinking just a bit, and perhaps I might set a hair running here. And it was great that Brian mentioned Heather Ball, and I think it was called A Socialist Life. The small section that Heather had in the Standard, which must be, oh, what now, 20 plus years ago. But I just wondered if these more, should we say, or shall I say, like sort of kitchen sink, true to life, everyday, day to day struggles type observation articles became more prevalent in the Standard after the unfortunate and very sad split situation with the Ashbourne Court group, and that perhaps there was a shift in the emphasis in the Standard after that. I honestly don't know because I wasn't there. So it's just a question, really, that maybe some of the people who were there and people have a more historical understanding of the party's trajectory would be able to enlighten us on. So thanks. But thanks, Howard. Really enjoyed it, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. I'll always love you. Thanks very much, anyway, for the praise. Yes, and for this sort of label, the kitchen sink label, not a bad one, actually. Did changes in the Standard sort of coincide with the departure of the Ashbourne Court group? It never crossed my mind, but there may be something in that. Yeah, maybe something that anyone who's sufficiently interested could think about looking into. Were we talking?
You mentioned it Howard, at the very beginning of your talk, and it was said about Marxism being put across with the
I wasn't specifically thinking of some kind of break taking place at that stage, though. I was thinking about it as a sort of more gradual thing, but I take your point. Can somebody date the? Was it something like 1990, the Ashbourne Court split? Have I got that right? Somebody must know.
1991.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Okay. Have you got your hand up as a legacy, Darren, or new comment?
I was going to comment again, just because obviously other people will know. First of all, on Andy's point, I would actually kind of disagree. I think perhaps what does happen is that when members do actually drop out or leave or pass away, you know, who are regular writers for the Standard, then that does have an impact on the colour of the Standard over a period of time. You know, if you have particular writers who wrote for decades and they're no longer there and they had a certain specialist subject, etc., then you could say there's a shift because people have to fill that space. But no, I would actually argue that the major, if you're talking about major shifts in the history of the Socialist Standard, I would argue that the greatest shift for me is probably the mid to late 50s. You know, I think it was only until the mid to late 50s that in any sense you had regular theatre reviews. You know, going back to the kitchen sink thing, you know, the kitchen sink drama, social realism, that you had film reviews. You know, the theatre reviews and film reviews in the Standard were incredibly sporadic. Before then, you know, practically non-existent, because like Howard said in his talk, there was this emphasis on what political politics, you know, and that probably... That'd mean that, you know, the editorial committee, maybe, or just the members who were writing for the Standard kind of replicated a certain style, a certain tone. But it was the case that certain, you know, might have been younger members. In the 50s was a guy called Ian Jones who wrote a number of interesting theatre reviews in the 50s. And obviously you had like New Wave Cinema in the 50s and 60s, which was being reviewed in the Standard. And what invariably happened is that when those writers either kind of left the party or just dropped out of their activity for a while, you know, nobody replaced them. So, you know, like you had like a whole wave of theatre reviews in the 50s, 60s. And then for whatever reason, the theatre reviews especially just kind of died away until kind of Michael Gill, you know, took up the mantle again in the 90s. And Steve Clayton as well, you know, in the 2010s, you know. So sometimes it's just individual members not being there to fill that space, you know. It's always amazed me that there's never been a regular, you know, you think of all the musicians in the party down the years, And this, like, the absence of like regular music reviews in the standards is kind of shocking, to be honest. You know, it's just a shame. You know, it's just a shame. But my original point, all it was going to make, and it was in response to what Howard was saying about the political politics. Sorry if I'm misusing the term. That I agree with that. You know, as somebody who's read a lot of the early standards, I agree with that. But what is interesting, and you're talking about ideas, possible ideas for like the future. Running alongside that through the years, there has been, you know, even in the very, very early standards, like 19, you know, the Edwardian period, there was also this tradition of the short story, you know, this idea of explaining socialist politics via like a short story, usually humorous. And there is a rich history in the standards of short stories. And obviously people like Heather Ball, but there's people that go back to the Edwardian period. So F.C. Watts wrote some really good short stories. W.T. Hopley was another really humorous writer. Ron Cook was a wonderful short story writer, you know, really wrote some excellent short stories. And if people are looking for ideas, you know, I honestly think, you know, it's like a companion piece to the Socialism Your Money Back, that maybe like the Pamphlets Committee or whatever, Publications Committee, why don't they go through the history of the short stories and standards and select, I don't know, 15 or 20, you know? You know, maybe more than that, because obviously we're not talking about particularly long pieces because they were for the standard. And maybe publish them in a pamphlet, you know, with like an introduction, you know, because some of these short stories actually are really wonderful, you know, really resonate. And also kind of put a different picture on both the party and the standards that maybe sometimes people have, and people have this mistaken impression that it was always kind of super po-faced, super Marxian. It was all about sort of, the, you know, three volumes of Marx and then throw in the Grundrisse for extra. And I just think there is also this parallel tradition in the history of the standards, which I think could have an audience even today, you know, and also gives an insight to who the party is and what our politics are, you know, in something far more maybe accessible than maybe the political politics stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Darren. You're the one with the knowledge on this. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, going back a long, long way. And, I mean, it's a good idea that you've thrown out there about collection of short stories, yeah. Yeah, sounds great to me. Just need someone to put them together. Not easy, because there aren't that many of us, and it needs someone to sort of, you know, give it the time and the energy. Fantastic idea. Anyone else? Adam, over to you.
Yeah, just to follow on from, you know, what Darren has said, because him and me, because we're putting stuff up on the him on the blog and me on our website. We've been through the standard right from 1904. I just wanted to comment on something you said about there being more informality in the party. We don't call each other comrades so much now, but I think this is a reflection of what has happened in the outside world as well. I mean, if the standards right up until the 50s, I think, would refer to politicians as as Mr. That or Miss This but I mean, you don't get that now anymore, even in the ordinary newspapers. They only refer to somebody as Mr. if there's some criminal charge against them or something like that. And even the we call each other by our by our first names. In fact, if you want to insult somebody, you will call them, comrade somebody. But even the conventional political parties now call each other by their first names. The Labour Party people go around talking about what's his name? Is he called Keir and Angela and all this? And this is in the Tory Party as well. So I think this is not just an evolution within the within the party, but in society more generally, and inevitably you know, because we're part of society, that, you know, this will reflect in, well, affect us too. There is one thing I think I can mention. Hope you don't mind me, Howard. I think at one point you took this a bit too far and you put your photo on an election manifesto, and there was a huge reaction against it. And I think there was even a conference resolution saying we're not allowed to put the candidate's photo on the election manifesto. In fact, you weren't at one time even allowed to send it to the press. But we've maintained the one we can't have the candidate's photo on an election address, but we do supply photos now to the local. To the local media. Anyway, so I thought I'd mention, I didn't really mean to be cruel.
But it was very effective, Adam. On that occasion, we got 92 votes and something like 3.5% of the votes cast. But okay, hopefully that wasn't the reason.
It's a very rare thing, that leaflet now. It copies around.
I've still got a copy of it, actually. right, okay. Thanks for that, Adam. Anyway, that's interesting. I'm sure that's true, that, you know, we're part of the society, and therefore what happens in the party must, to a certain extent, reflect what's happening in society as a whole. But that's certainly a good point. Andy, over to you.
Well, it was just in the absence of not very many hands going up. It was just to sort of reflect on that, really. I mean, I'm getting on now a little bit in terms of not as much as most of the people here, but I'm knocking on for 60. And I remember when I first went to work in, I think it was 1980. I think it was 82. I went to work in an oak panelled offices of an established construction company in Birmingham, and I was introduced to Sir Robert Douglas, and then I was introduced to Mr. E.H.G. Carter and Mr. D.A. Troth, and I was told by the people that were sort of looking after me on my first sort of couple of days to take them very seriously. You call them Mr. Troth and you call them Mr. Carter. And then when, I did quite well in that job. And I eventually got to the age of 21. And they, to my surprise, they held a little function for me to help. It was just a half an hour at the lunchtime to celebrate my 21st. And I think they gave me a couple of presents, which were books about construction technology. And I always remember Mr. Carter, who wore a tweed jacket with patches on the elbows. He was an ex-military civil engineer. He said to me, "Are you 21? You're allowed to call me Ernie." And this was it would have been about 1984 or 1985 or something like that. But it is really interesting how these sort of norms of sort of social divisions within the working class have sort of broken down now. People don't generally call their bosses Mr. So-and-so, and you may even have a boss that's a woman. And so it's all sort of gone, really, hasn't it? So maybe, just maybe, the way the standard has evolved also reflects those societal changes as well, you know, in terms of the... what some people would describe as the composition of the working class. But anyway, I just sort of float that out there and see if anybody first of all, finds my anecdote amusing, and secondly, just whether there's anything to follow on from that. So, thank you.
Definitely amusing, Mr. Davis. Yes. Definitely amusing. Thanks very much. Thanks. No hands up at the moment. So can I perhaps sort of say a word about something I was planning to say in the talk, but decided to sort of skate over because I didn't want to make it drag on too long, to do with the Life and Times column. I'm sometimes tempted to write about something that's what you might call too personal, and I sort of try to avoid doing that. So, for example, I mean, some people in the party might know that that I'm a vegan. I wouldn't suggest that, you know, to be in the Socialist Party, you've got to be a vegan, or that, you know, we should be saying that a socialist society would necessarily be a vegan society. Yeah, I would hope it would be, but okay, that's a personal view. But I did have the opportunity, you know, on the subject of veganism, to actually write a Life and Times about it, while at the same time, sort of, you know, not alienating party members who sort of don't sort of share my view of it. So. There was a piece which appeared, I think it was earlier this year, which I call Lifestyle Choices, Does It Make a Difference? And it was based on an opinion piece from the Scientific American website, which was entitled, a pro-vegan opinion piece from Scientific American entitled, A Meatless Diet is Better for You and the Planet. And it was written by Sarah Hull, who is assistant professor of cardiology at the Yale School of Medicine. And it recommends not just veganism, but vegetarianism as well. Okay. In this piece, I try to summarize her arguments and say I'm definitely sympathetic to the ideas she puts across and presents evidence for. But I then go on to say, I doubt that even if her recommendations were acted upon, recommendations for people not to eat meat at all, it would make much difference to the day-to-day problems experienced by millions of people. Since in capitalism, these are caused not by the right or the wrong diet, but by the system of production for profit. And I use this to make the point that enough food could already be produced to feed the world's population several times over, without pollution, without playing havoc with the climate. And I then go on to say this will not happen under capitalism, no matter how much people try to modify their diets or their lifestyle, or to put pressure on organizations or governments, etc. And that particular article ended in the following way, which I hope would sort of reconcile members, whatever, you know, wherever they were coming from on this issue. It said, in a socialist society, people will put their natural human capacity for cooperation and collaboration to work and use the resources of the earth to make sure that everyone, whether they choose to be vegan, vegetarian, or otherwise, has enough healthy food to eat and there is a secure, decent life for all. So I managed to get that in the end anyway, just as another example of a piece based not on sort of close personal experience, but nevertheless on something which is of a sort of, you know, particular interest and relevance to me personally. Janet, over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Howard. That was interesting. Always looked like you look back through historical, whatever they are, whatever it is. But the standard, as you referenced, has changed, because when I first started reading it, I think it was mainly, as you say, Marxian analysis, and quite hard to read, not easy to read for someone who wasn't used to reading that. and very useful and informative, but I think it would have it took patience. And now it's a much easier, I think it's a much easier read, and would it be more easily read by people who are not particularly interested in politics of any sort, but would like an analysis of society and on all the awful things that are happening and which many people are very, very, very worried about. So I think that the Standard has, as several of you have already said, it reflects the society, and the society has become more informal in that sort of way. And I also think people have become less reverential in any organisation, so that bosses are used addressed by their first names, where in the past it would never have been done like that. So that's another change that's come about. And dress also has changed in that people dress in very similar ways, and you wouldn't know that maybe someone could afford to go to a tailor in Savile Row, and others have to buy their clothes ready-made. So it's there has been a change for whatever reason, and I can't help feeling it's good rather than bad, in less being referential to those who are more well off, better off than others. Doesn't mean to say it makes the society any better, but it's a way of looking at things. And as I think Mike talked about in his comic thing, it might be a drip wearing away of how things are, hopefully, and so that change will be achieved, but and not scared. People are not frightened of change. They're sort of saying, well, that's changed, so we can do this, perhaps. Looking at things in a different way, which is also a good thing to do. And I think the use of the word comrade has always bothered me, because it's something that is used within societies that we wouldn't want to have anything to do with. And you might feel that, okay, if that's a comrade, then I don't really want it to have anything to do with those comrades. And it's a little bit of a difficulty of addressing. I think we do, some of us do still use it sometimes, but that's coming back, going back to the past almost, really. And I don't know whether it's good or bad or wrong or right, but does seem to be dropping out of use within the party. I think that also the Standard has been a remarkable production for 1904 since, hasn't it? So it's a extremely valuable product of the party. And I think that we should congratulate anyone and everyone that's had anything to do with it, because it is wonderful. I think it's wonderful. It was the one that first attracted me into the party, because I was looking for answers and couldn't find them as I wanted them. And then Comrade was selling the Standard in Trafalgar Square, and he was holding up the one that has the front cover, which asks, "Who needs leaders?" And this was one of the things that was questions that was bugging me all the time, because as I probably felt then as a quite young person, that those leaders weren't leading us anywhere very good, and we ought to be starting to go off in a different direction in that case, or something like that. So that it attracted me. And I think the latest Standard I like, the flooding one, picture of floods, it also ought to bring home a message to a lot of people, in that floods are not just happening in other parts of the world where there is already a lot of water. It's happening and happening in this country, and it's happening partly because of climate change, but partly because of the way that rivers are managed and are not sorted out in a way that they're made to go straight, apparently, when they should be meandering. And so that's not a good thing, not a good thing done for profit, but not for good, the good of the local communities in which the rivers run through. Okay, thank you. Bye now.
Thanks, Janet. The front covers of the Standard in recent times have been absolutely great, no doubt about it. And in fact, you know, people I've sort of given the Standard to and who read it sort of cursory or otherwise, who aren't members have always said, oh, it's a great, isn't it, a great journal, etc., even if they don't take it any further. I mean, a few years ago, we had a new member join what was then Swansea branch, and he filled in the application form, the questionnaire, absolutely perfectly. He knew exactly what we were about, and we admitted him. He refused to come to meetings for some reason, but he said he was busy doing his PhD, etc. But he was profoundly interested, etc., etc. And then come Jeremy Corbyn, he wrote and said, sorry, I've got to resign to give Corbyn a chance, which upset us a bit because, it suggested maybe he wasn't 100% convinced of our case. But in doing that, he said, but it's an absolutely terrific journal, what he said, while sort of leaving the party. So, must mean something. Can I just mention the other thing that Janet brought up about society generally being less deferential? That's absolutely right. And I do agree with that. That's a positive thing. And it's something, on reflection, I could have included in the good, the bad and the ugly column. That, that's a good thing that people are less deferential. They're less inclined to sort of, defer to their so-called betters. Just as, it's absolutely, it's not on the agenda now to be racist, with a bit of luck to be sexist. It's not on the agenda to be deferential. That's a good point. And I'm sure that's reflected in the party in various ways too. And in the way the Standard is written and the subjects the Standard covers. Paddy. Your turn.
Hiya. I can't resist responding to this sort of bit about how things have changed and how bosses talk to you, by your first name and stuff. I know that lots of us will be perfectly aware that this is a sort of partly, cynical ploy that at the end of the day they still are your bosses. And And even though they couch requests in the form of, if you can possibly find any time today, that would be wonderful, which means get out here now and do this. We know that's what it means. We know it's all code. Even so, I think we all appreciate that, this sort of informal work language is just less stressful. But I remember the very first job I got at the age of 17. I got a job in a pub, and this was a time when, well, you didn't need to be over 18 to work in a pub. Nobody really cared about that sort of thing. And we had to call the owner boss of the pub was this huge man called Mr. Bull, and we had to call him Mr. Bull, and he insisted on that. And he did look a bit like a bull, and he was very red faced because he drank all the time. So did his wife. But even though we had to call him Mr. Bull, it was a very, he didn't run a tight ship at all. And I was introduced by the rest of the bar staff, my first morning shift, when they said, have you had breakfast? And I went, no. And they went, oh, no, you get a full English breakfast here. Grab yourself a pint glass. So I did. And they said, right, just go down the optics from one end of the bar to the other. That's your breakfast. And that's what they did. That's how. And Mr. Bull didn't seem to mind at all. Even though he had to call him Mr., he just let everybody drink as much as they liked. I don't know how the place made a profit. But my last job, where everybody was super nice and it was all first names, the manager, or the owner, made a rule that everybody had to take turns to clean out the canteen, the staff canteen, because it was getting to be a mess, except he exempted himself and all managers. It was just the workers. Now, all the managers also used the canteen. I was absolutely ballistic and got into a row with the boss and practically accused him of running a Victorian sweatshop. But the reason I was so infuriated was because I've become used to this sort of informal thing where bosses don't swagger around and bully everyone and you know, sort of exercise naked power. You know, you do expect now that people behave in a reasonable, rational, sort of relatively egalitarian way at work. And the fact that he'd made this stupid exemption, he must have known how that it would antagonise the staff, and in fact it antagonised everybody, but nobody else said anything. I was the only one reckless enough to storm into his office and, you know, have a go at him. It was all very silly how arguments can develop at work over trivial things. But I can't help wondering if this whole thing about work and calling people by their first names, the origin of this was probably in new business theory from the 1980s, the so-called horizontal management theory, where you just remove a load of layers of management because it's, you know, more efficient, and you get more sort of cross-talk, not cross-angry, but talk across, rather than up and down rigid hierarchies. This was all a theory of the 1980s, 1990s, and I suspect all of this was, you know, this so-called culture that we've got was largely socially engineered by business theorists. But anyway, even in spite of that, I think most people will agree it's preferable now to how it was back when you had to call people Mr. Bull, even if they you could run riot while you were at work. Thank you.
Thanks, Paddy. Horizontal management theory was actually it started in the 70s, and the idea was that there wouldn't be hierarchies in businesses anymore. Everybody would sort of be on the same level, and that would make everyone sort of equal and happy and so on. Just the opposite's happened. I mean, it may have had the effect of making people more friendly, I don't know. But ever since then, business has got more and more hierarchical, business or any kind of employment. I mean, you know, the kind of employment I know best, I suppose, is universities. And God, the way things are now compared to the way they were then is mind-blowing, really. I mean, the pressure on people now from above at every level, the pressure on people, the pressure on people in sort of management, but not at the very top, to be absolutely mindless zombies for those at the very top, do exactly what they tell you, and the ones below that level of sort of management to do exactly what to make those below them do exactly what they're told to make them do is absolutely overwhelming. It's the kind of thing that simply that was unimaginable when I first started in that occupation in the 70s. And from what I can see, it's, you know, it's more widely spread than just in the world of education. Yes, Andy, do come in. There's nobody else got their hand up anyway.
Yeah, well, just on that point, I know we're going off a little bit, but maybe there's a Socialist Standard article in this. Is really the point that whoever I talk to now who have similar, you know, level of responsibility at work as I do, I'm a manager, but I'm not particularly important. I manage a couple of care homes, and I'm a registered manager with the Care Quality Commission. And what seems to have happened in the workplace, maybe we have had an article in the Standard about this, but I'm not sure, maybe I should write one, is it really doesn't matter now whether you work in an engineering company, or a sewage company, or a water company, or a chemicals engineering company, or care homes, everything is tied up with regulatory bodies. There's a regulatory body for everything. And no doubt the university sector, obviously the schools have Ofsted, I have the Care Quality Commission. You know, if you run a pub or a hotel or any other type of business, you're hidebound to these sort of statutory organisations. And so it makes everybody fearful of getting caught out. And in many ways, that stems from, you know, bad practices that arose during the origins of industrial capitalism, as we all know. But it's kind of reached a sort of a peak point now where you have all these civil servants essentially monitoring what people are doing in the workplace. And so everybody feels like they've got somebody on their back. So no doubt, Howard, the people in the university sector that feel under pressure from their higher management is because the higher management is under pressure from the regulatory bodies above. Quite why regulatory bodies would be involved in universities is beyond me. But it's everywhere now. It's endemic. And I just sort of make that point, really, about it is like, you know, the kind of the creeping state, you know, what I think, Howard, in your day, you might have called creeping fascism.
Thanks, Andy. Okay. Maybe there's scope here for a life and times theory on Paddy talked about horizontal management. Maybe there's scope for an article on peak vertical management, which is what it's very much become. Anyway, over to you. Are you there, Darren? Not hearing you at the moment. Oh,
yeah, sorry, I didn't hear you call me. Sorry. I was kind of following on from what Andy said. I was wondering how many of these kind of jobs or these regulations come under like David Graeber's old term, you know, term of bullshit jobs, you know, kind of wonder, curious. But I put my hand up again just to come back to the standard and its tradition, because I did want to make the point, following on from what Janet said, that I think it's to the eternal credit to the writers and the editors in the history that the standards that, yeah, it can be a difficult read, but overall, it has always been one of the most accessible and readable political journals, I think, out there. You know, even aside from our particular politics, I think it's very evident, even early on, that the early writers, the early party members, because they were seeking to reach out to the working class, the educated working class, you know, self-educated working class, rather. There was a genuine attempt to just, if you like, to apply a house style, which I think is still there to this day. And I know house styles are problematic. You know, the joke about the party's final paragraph, the standard's final paragraph. You know, we all know that. But I think it's to the credit to the party that it's always attempted to write in a clear, accessible style. That if you're reading the standard for the first time in good faith, then I think you can basically get the gist of where we're coming from, you know, our critique of capitalism, what our politics are in contrast. And, you know, and as one of the few members, not just in this meeting, but just in general, and I know this from my experience, who did make a point of like reading a lot of the left press, you know, the sawdust prose that I had to kind of like wade through, you know, and the jargon, you know, like so many journals. And I think unfortunately sometimes that's their attractiveness. You know, maybe it's because academics make, you know, no offense to Howard, but academics did make up a lot of the leadership of these various Trotskyist groups or Leninist groups. A certain jargon has always been employed, and it's almost like you have to kind of wade through that first when reading these journals to even get to whether or not you understand or agree with the politics being espoused in these journals. And I think it's to the credit to the Standard, and long may it continue, that it's always generally try to kind of reach out to people in a style. And I, you know, and as somebody who's tried to write, and I'm not a writer, it's actually harder to write in a clear and accessible way than it is to like fall back on like just recycling your college essays or whatever, which is probably what I tried to do in the past. So, you know, long may it continue, you know, and long may the party hold to that style, you know, that, you know, that as long as people are interested in our politics, interested in our journal, then we'll meet them halfway by presenting our politics in a way which is clear and accessible. Thank you.
Thanks, Darren. Thought we had Mike. He seems to. Oh, yeah. No.
Oh, the point I was going to make was made better by Darren. So thank you.
Okay,
Darren.
All right, Mike. Fine. That's all right. Okay, and Paul, in that case.
Yeah, thanks, and it's typically not unlike what. Mike just said there, you know, I was kind of reluctant to chip in tonight, but I think it's only fair and right to do so, you know, because a few people are making the effort. But really, maybe only possibly at risk of paraphrasing what Darren just said there, you know, it's like the Standard, just recently, in recent weeks, the book The Monument has appeared on YouTube as an audio book, describing the party as The Monument. Well, I would very much describe the Standard as the party flag bearer, I think is the term I'd be inclined to describe it. I mean, it's come through so many stages throughout the years, and I've been very, very fortunate to have a bunch of stuff from the 20s and 30s, you know, really, I'm talking about original copies when it was just like a double sort of A3, late A3, is that right? Yeah, A3 to A4s, maybe two or three pages, then it's gradually progressed from there and stood the test of time. Of course, it's gone all through all sorts of phases. But one thing I think we can all safely say is there's never been a poor article appeared in the Standard, and that's very much thanks to the outstanding work of the writers and, of course, the SSPC, several, or at least a couple of the members who are here tonight. And, you know, I sound like a bloody ass-kisser. That's not my intention, nor do I want to, you know, bum people up. Those who are here tonight that do write for it wouldn't accept any praise in that direction, but they certainly deserve the accolades, you know, for having put all the time and effort they do into producing the paper, and the writers too, and yourself in particular, Howard, who has always got something interesting to say, whether it's an article, a book review, or your absolutely brilliant back page. You know, it's a bit like when you get to the end of a news bulletin or something like that, and I'm not suggesting for a moment it's the compulsory sort of good news story to make you feel good. Not anything, but what I would describe it as a good way of giving it a really sort of human touch to it, you know, making real life stories, but also, you know, not this sort of negative way of just criticising capitalism and denouncing it, much as it deserves to be denounced, but giving good examples, you know, of your own personal experience without sort of try to blow your own trumpet, you know, anything, you know, it's certainly not like that. It just has such a good way of sort of making you feel quite warm and better about the world in which we live, you know. And it's, I mean, there's not all the writers, you know, from page to front to back page, every article, you know, we can all of us relate to, but as Dan made the point there, if you were someone picking up the Standard for the first time, it's not overly academic. It's got a good balance, you know, that people could find easy to understand and then progress. from there. So, you know, everything about it, I certainly still get a buzz when the letterbox goes at the beginning of a new month and I recognise the cover from the Standard. And I try and pace, well, I've got no choice but to pace myself out because of the nature of my sight issues. I can generally, some of our good comrade Robin Cox's articles might take me a few days to muddle through, but you know, the single page and in particular Paddy's good mix of humour combined with seriousness and some of his one-liners and the headings, they're all just superb of comrade Mike Foster's. You know, whether you're a regular or just an occasional writer, it's a terrific journal, and I hope that, you know, there's been a few sort of shaky moments when there was doubts about whether it could continue on a monthly basis and so on and so forth, but I certainly hope that we never see its demise and it's around for many, many years to come. So thanks to everyone who helps make it possible. I for one still look forward to appearing on my doorstep every month. So thank you, comrades. But I'll just give you one other little thing that I wanted to say on a separate issue, and that's the idea of addressing people as Mr. or Mrs. I even remember as recently as about a decade ago, turning up on my mum's street where I was born and brought up and getting out the door. And so it wasn't a work situation, it was just a neighbourly thing. And some of you of the certain age, this sort of whole respect thing for your elders, if you like. And a neighbour that I remember from my childhood had come up and said, "Oh, hi, Paul, and oh, this is your wife and your children." And her name was June Forwell. I said, "Oh, hello, June." My mother was sitting there. It's like my mum used to live in a masonette-type tenement flat, so she was sitting in her veranda. It was a warm, sunny day. And so I'd be in my late 40s, possibly early 50s, roughly. I can't remember exactly when my mum passed, but it was towards the end of her days. But anyway, I come up the stairs and she'd obviously overheard, and she actually pulled me up. She says, "Well, who are you speaking to there?" I said, "Well, June Forwell." She says, "June?" I says, "Aye." I said, and I'm thinking, "What else, have I got her name wrong? Is it Jane or whatever?" She says, "You know, I think that's a bit forward." And I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "Mrs. Forwell." I says, "For goodness sake, Mum, I'm a blown adult now, you know." And she says, no, Mrs. Forwell." Still refer to each other as Mrs. Edwards and Mrs. Forwell. Oh, well, okay, well, you know, it's changed days, but that just shows you that kind of whole old-fashioned type of respecting your elders was still very much abound then, you know, and that just sort of, you know, what we're talking about during this conversation. Well, it's been a lovely evening here and everything sort of triggered that memory. But no, thanks, Howard. It's been a pleasure to, and some of the headlines that you mentioned in the stories, it seems only yesterday, and obviously it hasn't been that long ago, but the ones that you mentioned bring back fond memories of having read your articles, and it's got such a nice, warm human touch that please don't ever give up. I think it sort of rounds off the whole reading of the Standard perfectly. So cheers. Thanks everyone for hearing me out. Cheers. I'll go at that. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks. Well, perhaps that's a fitting way to conclude the session, unless anybody wants to add anything else. We, as I understand it, there isn't a session next week. It's a holiday break or the week after. And we presumably will know soon what the programme is for January. Is that the case, Adam?
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are five Fridays in January, but I mean, I haven't fixed one up for the 3rd of January, but I'm assuming that's still the holiday period. But...
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be having a bit of time off then. All right. Okay. Well,
the 10th will be the next one that's scheduled, but yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Adam. All right. Well, good night to everyone, and... thanks very much for attending.